most difficult part of this job has been trying to figure out how to say at the beginning of all of these sessions, I'm Lou Smith, without feeling foolish about saying it all the time. You will probably have observed that I missed that on Tuesday, but I just got it in now by telling you how foolish I feel about saying it. The most common question that I get asked, whether here at Holden or at any other meeting that I go to, or in Wisconsin where I now live, is in response to the fact that I almost universally reveal myself as being from Bergen County, New Jersey, although currently living in Eau Claire. And everybody says, how did you get there? I'm not going to tell you that story, but I'm going to tell you the preface to that story. The 5 years before I was in Eau Claire, I was a campus pastor for Lutherans at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, which is on Long Island. I went there in 1972 to begin that ministry, and I vowed that when I went there, that before I did anything else, I would personally meet every Lutheran student in that student body. And having met both of them the first morning that I was there, it left me ample time to do other things. The one thing that I never did get to do, however, while I was there, was to meet all of the Jewish students in the State University of New York student body. That's by way of preface. I want to say to you all that in some sense, what I have done during the course of these 4 days is a spin-off out of my encounter with the Jewish community while I was campus pastor at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. My closest compadre in campus ministry there was the Jewish chaplain. We spent a lot of time talking together, studying together. Almost all the things that we did in that situation by way of Bible study were across the faith lines, and involved Jewish people in one way, shape, or form. And I guess I want to say that it was that encounter with Jewish people that in some senses really opened up the Old Testament for me in new ways. And as a result of that, I think led me to understand biblical faith as a whole in some more serious kinds of ways. I have often said, I think that the Jewish community can know who it is if there are no Christians around. But Christians cannot know who they are if we're disconnected from Jewish folks. It's a big disadvantage for us. Of course, it expresses the wisdom of the church in keeping the Old Testament, which in a sense embodies the Jewish mind for us, as a fundamental part of the scripture. It's not just preface to the New Testament. If anything, the New Testament is an interpretation of the Old Testament, which still sits as fundamental for us. To me, nowhere does the significance of dealing with my Jewish brothers and sisters have real import for me, have more import for me, than it does in dealing with what we deal with today, the Decalogue, the so-called Ten Commandments. Very Orthodox Lutheranism is not very well hidden from anybody who takes even half an eye to look at. And so, of course, having grown up in that and having allegiance to that, I have tended to understand the The Decalogue, the so-called Ten Commandments, I keep saying so-called, I think I'll explain why in a moment, so-called Ten Commandments in terms of what Lutherans have always thought of as law, that is kind of hard, demanding words that call us to account. Well, I observe that if you talk to our Jewish brothers and sisters and say, how many commandments are there in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, they will tell you not 10, but 613. Because that's how many there are. 613. More than that, they will also say that they do not refer to these particular collection of items that in the Decalogue as laws at all. They refer to them as the 10 words. We'll find out why in a little while. So that's kind of significant. Already my mind is starting to play some games and say, wait a minute, words? Not commandments? What's going on there? The other thing, yeah.
And Louis might add that Luther himself treated the Ten Commandments so-called as gospel in his essay in Ten Commandments.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I hope that comes out pretty strongly, yeah. Duane, along the way. Yes, Luther's got a lot of bad press with respect to things like Old Testament and commandments, but we all understand that in a very real sense, Luther's career was spent mostly as a professor of Old Testament. And it was on the basis of his reading the Old Testament as much as anything else that the Reformation in the Gospel came about. I mean, it focused in Paul and Romans, to be sure, but he learned most of his stuff about the nature of the justice of God, the saving justice of God, from the Hebrew Scriptures, where he did most of his work, lectured on them regularly. Yeah, thank you. In addition to that, my Jewish brothers and sisters pointed out to me in the course of reading the Ten Commandments that there are only two of those words that exist in the imperative form in Hebrew, that exist as commandments, that two of those words, and indeed I will argue the two most significant of those words, can't in any way, shape, or form be understood as commandments at all, but are simply out-and-out declarations, and that all the other words that are there, while they could be translated as commandments, don't necessarily have to be translated that way. They can be understood and rendered as descriptions. That's all by way of preface, and I have one more prefatory word before we get to the text. There are two versions of the so-called Ten Commandments in the Hebrew Bible. One is in Exodus 20, and the other one is in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Now, I was not at the second sitting of breakfast, but at the first sitting, Larry said Exodus chapter 21. I suspect this is a terrific example of how tradition is treason. Huh? The old saying, tradition is treason. I probably said to him Exodus 21, so I'm the source of the error in location. And he sort of passed it on and communicated it. You know, and now we have half of the village that thinks one version of the Ten Commandments is in Exodus 21. So as you wander around, at least correct that much during the course of the day. Yeah? Oh, boy, are we in trouble. Okay, well, in any event, okay, so if you can correct that, and I want to register publicly, I know that it's Exodus 20, right? Even though I'm probably the source of the error. Okay, one is in Exodus 20, the other is in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And during the course of this discussion, I'm going to basically be in touch with Deuteronomy chapter 5. So if you want to have a page open in front of you, that might be the place that you turn to and keep your fingers on, although I will make allusion and point to Exodus 20 along the way. Between the two lists, there are many differences. Some of them are interesting. In fact, I think all of them are interesting. Some of them are significant, whether there is any substantial change between the two lists, I will leave that for you to determine. I'll try to point out some of those differences along the way. There is, of course, one major difference between these two lists, and that is one of them in the narrative is first and the other one is second. And that's not quite a joke. The version in Exodus, which stands first in the narrative, purports to be direct speech from God at Sinai at the time of the making of the covenant with the Israelite people. The version in Deuteronomy purports to be a re-expressing of those commandments by Moses to the people some 40 years later. Now, there's some importance to that in the structure of the narrative. So why then do I choose the second version in the narrative, Deuteronomy 5, as a verse? I will simply assert this at this time. Anybody who wants to check with me the detail of the reason can get me later. I'll be glad to try to explain to you. I believe that in spite of its second place in the narrative, the Deuteronomic version of the commandments is older than the version in Exodus. And I want to use the older version. Remember, please, that the narrative of those first five books of the Bible was constructed after the fact. Nobody went through the Red Sea with a tape recorder on their pocket to record what was going on in process. Nobody went through the sea with a notebook and pen, or I suppose quill, in their hands, you know, marking things down so that they'd have an on-site record. Well after the fact, the stories were written down, and my opinion is that the older version of the commandments was placed first in the narrative, the earlier version second. And so while I'll draw on both versions, my primary point of reference will be Deuteronomy 5. So with that by way of preface, let's begin. The situation in Deuteronomy 5 is roughly this. After 40 years of wandering around in the wilderness, the Israelites are about to enter into the land called Promised. And at that point, a word is spoken to them by Moses, a sermon, if you will. Listen to Deuteronomy 5, verse 1. And Moses summoned all Israel. In other words, this is a public address in the midst of a gathering. He summons them all together, and he says, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I speak into your ears today." The first word is listen. Some things need to get done if the land called promise is to be fulfilled, if creation is to be achieved. And the way in which to get those things done is, first of all, by paying attention to certain fundamental givens. Statutes and ordinances, they're called in this text. And the way in which you pay attention to them is to quite literally, I love the literalness of the Hebrew language at this point, they are spoken into your ears. The sequence goes like this. There is speaking into the ears, there is learning, there is taking care, and there is doing. Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I speak into your ear this day, and you shall learn them, and you shall take care in order to do them. The doing is the last step. But in order to get there properly, the first part is listening, paying attention. I have this inordinate suspicion in my life that all of us have a tendency to want to do just about everything with the biblical word besides listen to it. We want to theorize about it. We want to invent doctrines about it. We want to defend it. We want to apply it. We want to do this, that, and the other thing. The first word is listen. Listen is a fundamental faith word. You may remember St. Paul at this point. Faith comes by hearing. Not a psychic or a mystical process, but a communication event in which mouths and ears are involved with words. Now Moses says in this sermon that he's going to put forward statutes and ordinances, but in fact the first thing he does is to record a piece of history. A very strange piece of history. Listen to verses 2 through 5 in Deuteronomy chapter 5. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time, to declare the word, to declare to you the word of the Lord. The Lord made a covenant with us. Forty years before this event was when that event at Sinai took place. And do you all remember why there was 40 years between Sinai and the entry into the Promised Land? The generation at Sinai has to die off. You're right. Huh? And yet Moses says, the covenant was made not with those back then, but with us who are alive here today, and God spoke into your ears. God spoke directly to you. But all the folks who were there are now gone. By biblical definition, are gone. And yet, this is not with our ancestors, but with us. I think one of the things that's going on there that we really need to pay attention to, and need today to pay really critical attention to, the fundamental unit in the Bible is not the individual, but the people, the community as a collective. God does not make in the Bible a covenant with this person and this person and this person and this person and all of these people, and then since he's made a covenant with all of them, gathers them all up together and they form a people. The covenant is with a people. And any individual is incorporated into that covenant, into that people relationship. That means, you know, that the issue of the faithfulness of any specific given individual Israelite is not what's at issue, but it's the community as a whole that's at stake. Now, if you operate out of an individualistic mentality, you're going to have a lot of difficulty with that generation of folks being somehow or another caught off before you go into the Promised Land. Then you got to say, they don't make it. They're not fulfilled. No. Even though they die off, they are part of the covenant people. And the covenant people come to fulfillment, and they come to fulfillment in that fulfillment. The fundamental unit of reality, of human reality, is the people, not individuals, in terms of the Bible. The Bible's asking us to think radically differently at that point. So we have this odd piece of history, a 40-year-old covenant made with us today, at that point. And then Moses goes on from there and follows what Yahweh, the Lord, God, said in this covenant. Here they are statutes and ordinances. I mentioned before that our Jewish brothers and sisters talk about them as words. They get that literally from Exodus chapter 20, verse 1. God spoke these words, says Exodus chapter 20, verse 1. All these words saying. So now the words follow as Moses preaches them to the people. And as I mentioned, only two are in the imperative for sure. What's the first word of this constitution, if you will? The first word of the constitution, thank you, Duane, is what Luther understood as the purest of pure gospels. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 6. I, Yahweh, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. That's the first word. Okay. Let's look at it for a minute. I just read that and I said, I, Yahweh. Does everybody here know what Yahweh is? Or is that a mystery word? Okay, let me try it by way of the story. I have a friend who was a member of a worship committee in his parish, and one of the other people in the worship committee on a parish was serving as a soloist in an Episcopal church in the same community. And at a lull in a worship committee meeting one night, this is a few years ago now, this guy said, I don't know what's going on with the Episcopal Church. He said, we got a new rector in this church, and every Sunday morning it's Yahweh this and Yahweh that and Yahweh the other thing. He said, at first I thought it was something like expressway or freeway, but I finally figured out that it's a person. And I don't know who it is, but I can tell you he's very big in the Episcopal Church. Okay. Yahweh is simply the proper name for God in the Hebrew Bible. It's the name that came out of our story of Moses on the mountain a couple of days back. God says, I will be what I will be. That's my name. And the shorthand expression for that in Hebrew is Yahweh. It's a proper name. Okay. God has a name. Now, I'll give you a quick reading hint in terms of reading the Old Testament in English. Yeah, if you have an RSV Bible in front of you and you look at it, you will see that the word Lord, which appears where I read Yahweh in the Bible, is written in all uppercase letters. Capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. Wherever you find that in the text of the Old Testament, at least in the RSV tradition, you can be 100% certain that the Hebrew behind that word is the divine name Yahweh. Okay. If the Hebrew word Lord is there, it'll just be L-O-R-D, lower cases. But when they spell it in all upper cases, the intention is to say the divine name stands behind that translation. That's important for us to realize. I'll try to tell you in a minute about how that tradition came about. But it's important for us to realize that the word Lord with uppercase letters represents a name, because if we treat it just as a kind of common noun, Lord, we get thrown a real serious curveball in the biblical text. Lord, as we normally use it, is a kind of function word or a relation word. Huh? I mean, it describes the relationship between the two of us if one of us is Lord. If you are Lord, whoever you are, that means you get to call the shots with respect to me. Okay? It's a function word. And I don't know much about you on simply the basis of the word Lord. I got to find out some more things, and I will find that out by recognizing your name. Okay? In this text, it's important for us to see that the word Lord is the proper name, the identifying mark, and God, the word God, which we normally treat as a name, is really the function word. God is a strange word. Okay. The word God is very strange. I use Luther as a starting point on this. If he had really good catechetical instruction, and therefore were introduced to Luther's large catechism, as well as the small catechism, this will be real familiar to you. Luther says in the large catechism, a God means that from which we are to expect all good, and to which we take refuge in all distress. See, it's a function word. Doesn't say who, it only says what at that point. Huh? In other words, God, the word God, functions something like a parenthesis in human language. It keeps space open in our language, space created by the fact that our lives are, as the philosophers would say, contingent. What I mean by that is simply this. We live in a world that is not our own creation, and it is not an extension of ourselves. But our lives are sustained by that world. If we are to live, we're going to have to take the food, the substance of that world, into ourselves, as well as the drink and the sunshine, and maybe the care of brothers and sisters. The world sustains us, but it is not us, and we didn't create it. More than that, we live in that world in jeopardy. For one thing, even 40 years later, Egypt is still pretty close at hand. Reduction to slavery is always a possibility. Perhaps even more fundamentally than that, we are mortal. We live in this world not eternally. We will die. And therefore, we live in the world bounded, limited. On the one hand, we need to seek good, and on the other hand, we need refuge from distress, in Luther's words. And the word God is simply the end result of our reflection on this life in the world. That's why you say God. It's not speculation about other worlds, not peculiarly religious information. It's because our lives are limited, bounded, and contingent. There's a parenthesis. But now, what's going to fill the parentheses? Because there are tons of candidates available, vying for that God spot, just dying to get into that parentheses with respect to us. That's the issue that is dealt with by the first of these words in the Liberation Constitution. They say, expect good from and take refuge in the one who brought you forth from Egypt, out of bondage, and bears the name Yahweh. Yahweh fills the parenthesis of God. There's an obvious Christian addendum to that, that I want to at least mention, not a correction, but an addendum that says, when you say God, Christian folk, right, when you fill that spot, you say Yahweh, the one who brought us forth from Egypt, and the one who raised Jesus, who gave his life for you from the dead. That's what fills the God parentheses. The first word of the Decalogue deals with the primary issue of faith. The second word of this Constitution is built on that first, and it is an out-and-out declaration. There will be no other gods for you besides me. That next word is not a word about asking us to do something. Please treat Yahweh as God. Please do this. Please do the other thing. It's an assertion. There will be no other gods for you besides me. Great consolation. Great consolation. You can trust Yahweh to maintain himself as your God, to beat off all of the rivals that would dearly love to replace him. Beyond your faithfulness or my faithfulness, your faithlessness, or my faithlessness, Yahweh maintains himself as God. And in a real sense, that's what the next word in the Constitution is all about. It's a description of what life is like among Yahweh's people. You will not make any graven images for yourself or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is on the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You will not bow down or serve them because I, Yahweh, am your God, a zealous God. I'm going to continue that sentence in a moment, but I just want to break there for a second. No graven images, no bowing down, no serving them. We've got a long way to go, huh? Is that ancient religion? That's what I used to think all the time. That has something to do with ancient pagan religions. You know, people worship birds and fish and all of that. And I made a tragic mistake one day. I was waiting in a cashier's line to buy something, and I looked at the money that I was going to use. Did you ever look at the money you use carefully? No. It's got birds and dead men stamped all over it. We had a great event right in American history was we put a dead woman on a coin as well. That was advancement. You know? The dead can birds and all kinds of stuff like that. Do you ever think of the kind of symbols that still carry our national identities? Huh? It's the American eagle versus the Russian bear, right? I suspect that's more sociology than ancient religion, folks, about what you bow down and worship. Got a long way to go. But fortunately, there is hope in this text because I, Yahweh, your God, am a jealous God. I visit the iniquities of the fathers upon the children to 3 and 4 generations of those who hate me, and show steadfast love to the thousands of generations, loving me and keeping my words, my commandments. God's jealousy is the defense of God's sovereignty. It's not an issue about God getting even, you know. I mean, we do not need God to spank us. We do well enough on our own with that regard. But we do need God jealous enough to defend himself and his sovereignty from all kinds of rivals. It places, and notice there are, it's limitation of iniquity. Only God, iniquity can only last for 3 or 4 generations. It's limited. The sovereignty, the jealousy of God limits iniquity, but it is faithful to the thousands of generations. And I don't think you're supposed to start and say 1, 2, 3, 4, and then when you get to 1,000, somehow or another, the steadfast love runs out, you know. As I guess he's from Sri Lanka originally, Ceylon, theologian named D.T. Niles, who said what this word, steadfast love, the Hebrew word, you teach a good Hebrew word every day, this Hebrew word is chesed, okay? Chesed. It was always translated in the old English tradition as mercy. It's come into our liturgies. It's come into our liturgies. Lord, have mercy on us. It's a rendering of that Hebrew word chesed. And D.T. Niles said what chesed really means is kindness that never gets tired. Maybe arrange that over against your own kindness and find out what never gets tired really means. So the next word is about God's jealousy. And the next word in this constitution deals with God's name. You will not take the name of Yahweh, your God, in vain. For Yahweh will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Among Yahweh's people, the name is not dishonored, because to do so would jeopardize the whole liberation enterprise. To dishonor the name means to get something else in that God parentheses. When that shift is made, now let's face it, it's not God that's in jeopardy, it's us that's in jeopardy when one other than the liberation God comes into play. To dishonor the name is to try to convert God. Again, God preserves his own name. God does not let abuse of the name go unattended. Now you can take that as threat, I suppose, or you can take it as promise, as I'm inclined to do. If you see the significance of this name, then God's protection of his name is for our sake. Now the next two words in the Constitution are the only two words that are definitely in imperative form. Our third and fourth commandments, if you will. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 5:12. 5:16. Honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God commanded you. The only two that are specifically in commandment form. I reflect on why, and I think the texts themselves tell us why. Let's look at the rationale first of the third commandment as it appears here. We get a sermon in a sermon almost. 6 days, this is 5:13, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servants or your female servants or your ox or your ass or any of your cattle, nor the foreigner who is within your gates, so that your male servants and your maid servants may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. The rationale for Sabbath in this text is quite clear. It's there for the sake of our liberty. Slaves work 7 days a week. And the one thing you are commanded to do is to not become a slave again. You are free, but you are not free to become slaves in this world. Look at the logic of the commandment about mothers and fathers. Honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God commanded you, so that your days may be prolonged and it may go well with you in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You know what I think screws us up most with respect to fourth commandment? We all learned it as kids. Oh, really. We all learned it when we were 7 or 8 years old, right, in Sunday school, and therefore our parents were our 30-year-old parents. But this word was spoken to all of those 30-year-old parents about their 60-year-old parents, see? In other words, what's going on here is you got really the first piece of legislation about care for the elderly. For an obvious reason. Huh? The one thing wrong with youth culture is that nobody stays a youth, right? And there's one thing that can be said about everybody in this camp. We're all getting older, you know? I don't notice that so much in Martha as 6 years old. I call it growing, but she's getting older too. All of us are. And if there is a community that does not have a fundamental care and respect for the elderly, sooner or later, all of us are in jeopardy. Because all of us get there. If there is to be well-being, if it's to go good for us and long days in this land, then we better have a community that is going to sustain old people and care for them. It's very interesting. Now, a very interesting word that's used here with respect to honor. I can't help but pull it out and hold it up for you. Now, you all know that God says throughout the Old Testament, right, I do not share my glory with another. Huh? How many of you have heard that? I mean, that's a pretty common word. I do not share my glory with another. The word that gets translated as honor here in the text is the Hebrew word for glory. What belongs only to God and what doesn't get shared with anybody else comes into one place in the Hebrew Bible with respect to human beings. Give glory to your mother and your father. This community cannot afford to make some people outcast and unattended on the basis of age. Destroys the community as a whole. Well, the rest of the commandments, they're nice and they're brief and they're straightforward. They don't require much by way of exposition, I suppose. What needs to be said, however, is that none of them are in necessarily commandment form. They exist as descriptions of what life is like among free people. Among free people, there is no murder. I mean, what yields murder? The sense of adversity among us, the sense of competition, the sense that you're going to co-opt my place, the sense I need you out of the way. All that belongs to the mind, to the slave mentality, which is only the mirror image of Pharaoh's mind. Huh? You will not commit adultery. What's that all about? The fundamental respect for the care of the community. I think the Bible takes sex far more seriously than most of us do. It's not a casual kind of relationship. There's a fundamental word of address spoken between people in a sexual relationship. And where communities are serious, the commitments that people make to one another are held seriously. You realize that the word adultery came to have serious connotation of religious unfaithfulness in the history of Israel. I think that's how seriously we need to take that word at this point. Stealing? Among free people, there's no stealing. Why? Stealing is the sign that we're grabbing for this affluence that only weights us down. And false witness, probably in this sense, is probably a legal term. I mean, I don't have much use for gossip, particularly where it's about me and particularly where it's not nice. But this probably doesn't relate to gossip as much as it does to kind of fraudulent speaking in court, the kind of thing that can get people's property away from them. And coveting, it's related to the basic support mechanisms of life, from spouse to home to field to employees, if you will, to the animals, anything that is your neighbor's that supports their life. See, what's at stake in all of these commandments is that the basic integrity of the free life of the community, where it's intact under God, yields this kind of life. Where any of these things exist, the one thing you can be sure of is that there's no freedom. The first word hasn't been heard. Huh? I always do that with respect to stealing in my own head. You know, the fact of the matter, locks are a sign of bondage. I mean, I lock my house. But it's a sign of bondage. If somebody else locked me in my house, I'd say I was imprisoned. When I do it to myself, I say, aha. know, there, isn't that nice? I can lock my house up. But I lock my house up because this community is still not yet free that we live in. You know, in a free community, these things don't exist. Wherever they exist, they are signs that there is no freedom yet. Now we need to be clear. Only the right hearing of the first word can ensure the happening of the other words. Where the first word is missing, we won't have this as a descriptive constitution of our life. We won't have it as what our Jewish brothers and sisters call Torah, instruction, a good and encouraging word. We'll have here rules and laws and demands that only say, do it better. But the do it better will reveal that we haven't heard the first word properly, that our trust is falsely placed. Well, I choose to end this whole session by turning out of the first books of the Hebrew Bible and just making a quick reference to one little saying from the prophet Jeremiah. It's intended to be a kind of conclusion that hopefully puts everything in the perspective of hope. It's Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 11 and 12. The word of the Lord came to me saying, Jeremiah, what do you see? And I said, I see a rod of almond. Then Yahweh said to me, you have seen well, for I am watching over my word to perform it. There's a pun involved in that, right? The Hebrew word for almond tree is shaked. And the Hebrew word to take care of, to watch over something, is shoked. Okay? So almond suggests watching over. That's the pun. But all I want to hold up is that little verse as the kind of sign of hope. If there's good news of the liberation of creation, hope is that Yahweh, who creates and who delivers and who converts, and who sets his word among us to make and keep us becoming his free people, that this Yahweh is watching over his word to do it.
Of course, that's got to
be. Yeah, no, it is. At that point, the form is the same. The major difference is, I kept watching my little pen watch here and dropped some stuff out, but the major difference is that you'll find in Deuteronomy and Exodus, the major difference that there is in the logic of the Sabbath. The Exodus commandment connects the logic of Sabbath with creation rather than Exodus. Okay? But the form of, and those are the kinds of things that shift, but the form of the words is identical. In the linguistic form of the words is identical throughout. Oh, okay, that's a good story. Hebrew was a language that was originally written with no vowels. And the four letters that make, the four consonants that make up the word Yahweh in English would be Y, or J if you're German, right? H, W, H. Or again, if you're German, VH. You get that V sound. Our ancient Jewish brothers and sisters heard this word about the name of God, this word, about not taking the name's Lord in, the Lord's name in vain, Yahweh's name in vain. And they said, well, you know, let's take out a little insurance policy on not using it in vain by not using it at all. Okay? You will quickly realize that won't work, right? But, you know, I mean, even our ancient Jewish ancestors made mistakes here and there, okay? But that's why they said, let's not use it at all. And somebody said, well, what are you going to do when you get to the word in the text? They said, well, let's substitute the word, now literally the word for Lord, which is in Hebrew Adonai, A
Adonai, A-O-A, okay? And let's substitute that word whenever we read it. And I said, yeah, geez, you know, but you can't erase Yahweh and stick Adonai in all the time. And I said, well, what we'll do is, obviously, this is not me, nobody ever sat down and said this, I mean, I'm kind of exploring this logic, but what we'll do at this point is that we'll take the vowels from Adonai and we'll write that in the middle of the consonants Yahweh, okay? Now what you end up with is any kind of linguistic branch, you end up with a word that that doesn't function Hebrew-wise. But if you transliterate it, just render the sounds into English, you get J-A-H-O-W-A-H, Jehovah. And some people came along and recognized this as a name, and before they did too much scholarly work with the text, just transliterated it. So Jehovah is just really sort of a bastardization of Yahweh, if you will.
Very late one, too.
Oh, quite late, yes. Yeah, quite late. I mean, this doesn't go back very far.
What about other names like El Shaddai and Elohim? Why don't those come up like Yahweh?
Okay, Elohim isn't a name. Elohim is a generic. It's like our word God. There's some more could be said about that, but let that stand for now. There are some other titles. What's the right word? Ascriptives, appellatives, or whatever the right word is, that are used with respect to God in the Old Testament. Like, for example, El Shaddai. El Shaddai, I think it'd be better looked on as a title. I guess it literally means something like God of the High Places or something like that. El is a word that functions just like Elohim does. It just means God in the same sense. El Shaddai means God of the High Places. And there's a point in the Exodus account in the Genesis account where God says to Abraham, you know, I used to be known as El Shaddai, but now, or is that in, I don't know, but someplace along the line, you have this kind of thing where Yahweh sort of runs around claiming all of these ascriptions and titles for himself, but the name, the one name is Yahweh. Well, thank you all. I appreciate the time to have been with you.